The show is live and local. It's your connection to local performances. I'm Kevin Kelly. On the program today, a show I've been looking forward to for some time, we have a Celtic harpist and storyteller, Patrick Ball. He has been in our area before, each time, I believe, at Heartland Gallery in downtown Urbana, and in fact, he returns to the gallery tonight for a show at 7:30, and he's returning to us here on Live and Local. The difference is this time we get to hear him play live instead of simply hearing from his previous recording, so I'm personally excited about that. Hope you will enjoy it. I think you'll find it a very special sound, and hope you stick around. For the hour, Patrick Ball on Live and Local. We heard members of Ensemble Galilei from their album called From the Edge of the World. That was called Crossing Baffin Bay, composition by one of their members, Carolyn Anderson-Sirk, who happens to also be their bass viol player. You're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly, and I'm very pleased to welcome back to our show today Patrick Ball, who is considered one of the world's finer Celtic harpers and also spoken word artists. He is quite a storyteller. He has a wonderful thing that he calls Theater of Legend, Celtic Harp and Story. And he's making a return appearance at the Heartland Gallery in downtown Urbana tonight at 7:30. Wonderful place to hear the Celtic harp, because they specialize in Celtic arts of various kinds, and it's a very intimate space and has some nice resonance to it. And I would think it would sound wonderful for Patrick. He's been on the show a couple times before, but each time I think it's either been in the wintertime or the combination of climate or weather, rather, and how much time you had available to get here didn't actually allow for the harp to get acclimated to our studio. And so apparently there would have been issues, and so we've chatted before. But I thought I had seen your instrument, but it doesn't look like what I'd seen before. So there it is. It looks ancient indeed. Is it in fact?
Well, no, actually, it's not ancient. It's but it has been on United Airlines a lot. So that ages.
Which means it's at least been
people.
Put through the ringer, yeah?
Yeah. No, actually, it was made in 1980, but it's patterned after a design which was not really popular, but at least it existed about 300 years ago. But this is a wire-strung harp, and wire-strung harps were played in Ireland at least 1,000 years ago. And there's no reason, no one came to figure out exactly why Ireland is the only place on earth where they played harp strung with wire strings. These are brass wire strings, but it was. And they played for about a thousand years, and then about 200 years ago, these harps just died away for musical reasons and political reasons. They just flat out died out. And for 200 years, nobody played them, nobody made them, nobody heard them. And then finally, this fellow out on the West Coast, a guy named Jay Witcher, who was an aerospace design engineer, decided he wanted to make them again. And so he began to make them. He went to Ireland, and somebody showed him into one of the back rooms of the museum. Then he saw all these festering old wire-strung harps that could not be tuned up because the wood by that time was far too brittle. And but he took the measurements, and being an aerospace design engineer, it was no problem for him to make one of these things. And so he made his first one many years ago. And this harp here, I think, is number 700 and something or other. So he's been pretty busy. And he continues to make them. He lives out in Holton, Maine. He used to live in California, very close to where I lived. He had about an acre of land in Northern California. And he sold it. And with the money that he made from selling an acre of land in California, he bought half of Maine.
That's literally true.
Yeah, absolutely. And, well, maybe not exactly true, but the thing that he loved about going to Maine was that part of his acreage included a whole tract of hardwood forest, including, you know, these maple, rock hard maple. And so he moved back there, and he set up his own shop, and he set up his own kiln to dry the wood. And so the wood that he chose to use was very, very hard. This particular harp here, which is about 4.5 feet tall, was made of a soft maple. And so I'm no expert on the dynamics of instruments, but over the years, this harp has become very resonant. And I eventually got one of his newer harps with rock maple, and it was a gorgeous instrument and sounded great, but it will probably take about 20 years before it begins to sound the way he would probably like it to sound. But this thing has been through the ringer. It's been everywhere. And so it kind of wears off the rough edges and gets a little bit more resonant. So,
and the reason for the increasing resonance is because it started as a softer wood and it hardens over time?
Well, I don't really know the physics of the whole thing, but it's like a violin. You know, if a violin is made very well, the wood begins to temper. And I think one of the things about a wire-strung harp particularly is there are 32 brass wire strings pulling as hard as they can. I mean, to get the proper sound out of this instrument, the strings have to be incredibly tight. and close to the breaking point. And so as the years go by with 32 wire strings pulling like crazy, it eventually pulls the harp into the shape that the harp maker eventually wanted it to be, which included a sound board which bells out and gives it more space. And I think something to do with the molecules or something start beating against each other, and they become warmer, more resonant. And that's what happened to this harp. And it probably did not help the fact that in Salt Lake City it got thrown out of the airplane and got a big crack in the back.
Oh, wow.
But it worked for Willie Nelson's guitar, so it probably works for this instrument,
too. I can't see that from that angle. Does it still have that crack?
It does. I was out doing a storytelling festival in Vernal, Utah, which is somewhere about 3.5 hours outside of Salt Lake City. It's where the Dinosaur National Park is or something like that. And I flew into Salt Lake City and rented a car and drove straight to this place. And that night I opened up the harp case and started to tune the harp. And I happened to look down and there was this big crack in the back of the sound box. And so I said, good grief, is there anybody around here that, you know, fixes instruments, you know, fine instruments? And they said, no, there's no one like here, but my husband's got a big bag of tools. And so so her husband came over and brought this massive great C-clamp and attached it to where the crack was, because it was not just cracked, but the two sides of the pieces that had been pushed, the tension on the wood is so great that when the pieces of wood cracked, they became unaligned, and so they were pushing into each other. And so he attached this freaking great C-clamp to the thing. And I said, you know, we got to put some glue in here or something. Mm-hmm. He said, no, we don't need any glue. And so he put some glue in anyway, and he just cranked this thing until finally the wood gave way and went into a reasonably solid place. But the thing about these harps is that if you take the tension off the strings, there's just so many dynamics going on in this instrument, and the resonances are so complex. If I'd loosened all the strings, God only knows where it would have ended up. So we just took the C-clamp and tightened it up and put the glue in there, and it seems to be doing all right.
And it's never gone back to its maker to well, properly fix?
He lives in Holt in Maine, right, which is pretty far away. And he's also one of these guys. He's a great perfectionist. And when people are buying his harps, they go, well, you know, you said my harp would be done in a year, and so I was wondering if I could pick it up or you could send it to me. He says, I can't send it to you because it's wintertime now, and where you live, it's kind of hot, so I couldn't risk it would crack. And so they'll phone back 6 months later, and they say, well, can you send it now? He says, well, no, I can't because it's summertime here and it's cold there. So again, the harp maker is actually quirky and unusual as the instruments itself, but it seems to be doing well. And I think over the years, that which does not kill us makes us stronger. And this harp just got back from Scotland. I was just in Scotland recently, and you know, the temperature over there was so different from when I left California. That, but I think it thrives on moisture. Oddly enough, I don't really know why exactly. Dryness and altitude are difficult for the instrument, but moisture and kind of a stable, soft weather is what it really likes.
Well, let's see how it likes the climate in our studio here.
I don't know if I can play here because it's kind of... No.
We've been building this up. Don't say that now.
Sorry, we can't. Yeah. Well, anyway, this is a 32-string... it's sometimes called a clarshach, or simply a Celtic, wire-strung Celtic harp. And you play it with your fingernails, you can hear the brightness of the instrument. And that's because the hardness of the fingernails is plucking on pure monofilament brass wire. And so I don't know if it means very much to your listening audience, but to me, I always think it must have been a really extraordinary moment when these harps had died out 200 years ago, but this maker suddenly decided to make them. He began to play them and make them, and he tightened up the strings, got all the materials in place, and tightened it and tuned it, hopefully. And suddenly, after 200 years, a sound which was gone, and in the minds of many people, gone forever, suddenly returned.
I was just about to say, it almost seems a crime to dampen that sound. It just rings and rings and rings. I mean, even when you just plucked it initially to do a little demonstration, it's remarkable, the resonance coming out of that those very thin wires.
Well, that's the hallmark of the instrument, really. And from the earliest times, the people who commented on the instrument always remarked on the resonances and referred to it as like the sound of the pealing of bells. And although there were some people who weren't quite so enthusiastic about it, you know, it had a legendary status in the old days. The harp players were very, very highly honored. But eventually they died out. And shortly before they died out, they had a harp festival in Belfast in 1792, which was entitled the Belfast Harp Festival of 1792. And they invited all the remaining masters of this instrument. And they can only find eight. And only one person played with his finger nails. All the rest had stopped playing with finger nails and started playing with finger pads. And if you know anything about playing a wire-strung harp with your finger pads, you know you won't be playing it like that for very much longer because it's very, very hard on the finger pads. So shortly after that, they stopped playing wire strings and switched to harps with gut strings. And the gut strings resonate probably maybe a third as long as these. So this is really the hallmark of this instrument. But the great Irish revolutionary politician Wolfe Tone attended some of these concerts at the Belfast Harp Festival 1792. And his pithy and telling remark after leaving it was, "Plunk, plunk, and be damned." That was his opinion of harp playing.
Yeah,
so
that's it, huh?
So it doesn't please everybody.
No, well, it says something about politicians, too. Probably.
Yeah.
Well, you've talked about the fact that these things died out and then were resurrected in part by this fellow who's now in Maine. How did you get hold of one? Or really, I guess that even puts the cart before the horse. What made you think about getting hold of one?
Well, that's in my opinion, a gripping yarn.
And you're known for telling dripping yarn, so feel free to embellish as much as you
like. Well, I don't know
like.
If I ever meant, I've ever told you this story before, because I've been here a couple times before, but since you don't remember the look of the harp, you probably wouldn't remember what I said the last time I was here anyway. So
I'll let you know.
Okay. well, to start at the beginning, I went to the University of California at Davis, where my daughter goes right now. And when I went there long ago, I had one great, really great teacher. And you know, it's funny when I, you know, when I'm talking to an audience, I always look out there and wonder how many people have had a really great teacher in their lives, because I don't think too many people really have. But this guy was truly a great, great teacher, and he taught modern European history at 9 in the morning on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And he was the type of guy that if you ever saw him walking around the campus, like here, if you ever saw him walking around, you wanted to talk to him, you walked up to and tried to talk to him, he'd talk to you, but you could detect no personality whatsoever in this guy. But when he stood in front of 800 university students at 9 in the mornings in a lecture hall, which was about 800 seats, and it was always filled, he was the most marvelous person you could ever imagine. And I don't really know why, but when he talked, and I remember it very clearly, whenever he talked about history, he not only made you want to know everything he had to say, all the names, the dates, the wars, all the bloodshed, he made you want to know everything he had to say. And better still, and everybody else feels the same way about this, he not only made you want to know all this stuff, he made you want to go back into the past to find out what all these people were like that he was talking about. He really made you want to go back and find out, to find out what they loved, how they were like you, how they were different. He made you want to go back, but you cannot go back into the past. But when he talked, and I'm not a particularly fanciful person, but when he talked, it felt like a very thin veil dropped between me and the past. He was so wonderful that you could almost see through that veil into the past. You could almost put your hand through it. You could almost step around into the past, but you cannot get back into the past. Well, I graduated and I got a master's degree in Irish history, and I immediately got a job painting houses, because there were no jobs, obviously, for people with master's degree in history. And one day, then the guy that I was working for, the contractor, he had a PhD in physiological psychology, but he was a contractor, and he had a really rich girlfriend. And one day, his girlfriend and I went to a Renaissance fair, one of the early Renaissance fairs in Northern California, in a town called Novato. And we're walking along at this fair, and suddenly I heard this sound that nobody'd heard for 200 years. And nobody believes me when I say this, but when I heard that sound, it felt like that veil separating me and the past just went whoosh, and was torn away. And I felt, when I heard this instrument, that I could step right back into the past. So I said to that woman that was with me, I said, "Would you buy me one?" And she said, "Sure." So she bought me a small version of a harp just like this, about the same shape and same characteristics, except it had one less octave. So she bought me this harp right on the spot. And when I got back to the house, I paid her back because I had some money from working for her boyfriend. And but I always think that I could never, ever, ever pay that woman back, because, you know, when you think about people's lives, you're going through your life and, you know, maybe you meet somebody or you don't meet somebody, or you step off the curb at the wrong moment, your life goes someplace you never dreamed of. That's what happened to me. I was at the Renaissance Fair. I heard this instrument. I started to play it, and I was getting paid $7 an hour to paint houses. And I learned three tunes on this instrument, and I went and played on the street in San Francisco, a place called Ghirardelli Square. I put my hat out, and I made $8 an hour. And so that's how I became a professional.
$8 trumps $7 anytime.
Yeah, absolutely. And you didn't have to smell lacquer thinner or do any of that stuff. So I started playing on the street with 6 months later, he made me this instrument here, and I would take it out on the street and play. And the reason that it was really extraordinary for me and everybody else was because that nobody had ever seen one of these things before or heard one. And it would pretty much stop people in their tracks, you know, for at least three tunes. They didn't have to learn any more than three tunes. They all left after that. But it was a great, you know, it was a great sort of serendipitous moment in my life. And so after that, I had spent a certain amount of time in Ireland working on my master's thesis. And so I knew a lot about the culture and the history. And I got absolutely fascinated by this fellow, Turlough O'Carolan, whose piece I just played here. And learned more of his music and more stories. And that's how I started to play this instrument, because it was Jay Witcher, the harp maker, who was selling the harps at the Renaissance Fair. That's how I started out.
Ah, nice coincidences or serendipitouses. Yeah. However you want to describe those. We're talking with Patrick Ball here on Live and Local. He is going to be at Heartland Gallery in downtown Urbana tonight for a show at 7:30 till about 9:30. He's been there before. He's been here before, and we're very pleased to be welcoming him back on the show to play for us live on the program today. Our programming on Live and Local today is made possible with support from Sinfonia da Camera, whose 29th season features a 90th birthday celebration for composer George Walker, Beethoven's Symphony No. 9, Holst's The Planets, Bach's St. Matthew Passion, conducted by Fred Stoltzfus, and Rush Hour in April. Ticket information is available at 333-6280. Heartland Gallery will be where Patrick is this evening, and you'll hear the music, and you'll hear some storytelling as well. And I'd love to hear some more music from you right now. I'm so fascinated by the stories that I could get lost, even if it's merely a story of your own life. But yeah, I'd love to hear some music.
The more stories I know, the less tunes I have to learn. So
is that how that goes?
And I find it...
You don't forget them, I presume.
Well, let's not go
there. The tunes.
Yeah. But one of the things that's lovely about playing this instrument is that there's so many stories which were told about this very particular instrument. And so I'll play a tune, and then if I may, I'll just tell you a story, a really old, old story inspired by this instrument. So here's the tune. Thank you.
I was once a very young boy who lived all alone with his mother in the farthest northwest coast of Ireland, maybe Donegal. And this young boy loved nothing so much as to wander along the sands after a storm to find out what the ocean had cast up, because he used to find treasures washed up on the shore. Well, one morning, after a tremendous, great storm, he wandered along the sands, and what did he find washed up on the shore? But all things he found, a harp in tune. So I picked it up and he put it under his arm and he continued his wanderings along the sands. But in the course of his rambles, his fingers strayed against the strings, and the sound that came out was to him so enchanting that he ran right back to his mother to show her what he had found. And all through that day he plucked on the strings, and the sound that came out was, it was marvellous. But he soon found that he could not shape that sound into music. And as day followed day and he plucked on the strings, he got more and more depressed, because he found he had a great deep love of music in his heart, but he hadn't any skill for it in his fingers. And so he slept very little, he ate nothing, and his mother, who of course was very wise and beautiful and young, understood her son's pain, but she could give him no comfort. So she went down the way to the druid man under the oak tree, and she said, "Please, please, either give my son the gift of music, or for the love of God," she said, "would you take away from him this desire to play music?" And the druid, in proper pre-Christian druid fashion, says, "What'll you give me if I do the one thing or the other?" She says, I'll give you whatever you ask of me." He says, "Well, give me your soul, and I'll give him the gift of music. Give me your body, and I'll take away from him this desire to play music. It seems to me, says he, like a simple choice." She says, "You take my soul. You take my soul, for I would have my son a great musician." And so from that day out, the son became the greatest harp player in Ireland. But the mother, when she died, which was not long after, had to give up her soul and go away down to the other world, where they say to this very day, even now, she sings a song called the Bron Omna, or the Soul Agony. And you know what? The old people say that during the daytime this boy could play music of such gladness that he could charm the eagle from the wren, the hawk from the dove, and the fox from the lamb. They also say that at night He could hear the soul agony of his mother, and it would tear at his heart. And they say that you could hear her singing in the music that he played.
Patrick Ball, live on Live and Local, playing the harp, telling a tale of at least one young musician on this instrument.
You know, whenever I hear this, whenever I go to Texas a fair amount, and one of the last times I was there, I was driving through the agricultural and drug enforcement checkpoint near Van Horn, Texas, where Willie Nelson gets busted about once every year. You stop his bus and pull him off and get the dogs in the bus. And
you have a passing resemblance to him, by the way.
More and more so. Yeah, it's not a pretty thought. But anyway, it reminded me, I was down there, and Willie plays down in Alpine, Texas sometimes, and somebody told me this, and it's probably true, that when Willie was a young boy, he said, "Mama, when I grow up, I want to be a musician." And she says, "Son, you better make up your mind, because you can't do both." And there's a sad truth in that story. When are you going to get a job?
Yeah. Well, while you were telling that story, I was just sort of thinking of my own life in music, and I imagine many people, when you tell stories like that, particularly when it's accompanied by the music, and I think that's a big part of it. It can really dig deeply into somebody else's life. Because the tales come from either real life or somebody's telling of stories that are sort of archetypal of many people's real life. How did you get interested in the whole storytelling thing? I mean, that came, I guess, technically after music in the first place, but it preceded your discovering the harp.
Well, I got interested in stories mostly because I was in places where people told stories. I mean, when I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and to my knowledge, nobody ever told what you'd consider a story, and we didn't have a cultural tradition of telling stories. I mean, you sit around and you talk about things, but they weren't really stories. And although there'd usually be there's always almost one person in everybody's family that is a natural storyteller, and my aunt is that way, and she'd be telling stories constantly. And my mother will say, "That never happened. That never happened." And it seems like in everybody's DNA there's or family there's always one who's a storyteller. But I lived in North Carolina in the mountains, in the Blue Ridge Mountains, and my first experience of storytelling was working with a guy who had lived up in the mountains all of his life, a man named Charlie Stevenson. He was the groundsman at a school called Penland School of Crafts up in Penland, North Carolina. It's a very famous craft school. And my second cousin was the director for a very long time, so I was hitchhiking around the country. And I got to Marion, North Carolina, and I phoned home to tell my mother where I was. And she says, "Your cousin runs a craft school." And so I went up there. And their son, Jerry Brown, did not apply himself in school. And so they said, "Would you like a job mowing the lawn here for 6 weeks while he's in school?" I said, "Yes, I would." And I ended up staying for a year and a half. And my first job, and this is a true story, my first job at this school, they introduced me to Charlie, the head groundsman. And the first job we had was cleaning out a bunch of bees which had infested the rain gutters in this sort of rustic little dormitory where the students stayed. And I didn't know anything about getting bees out of a drain gutter or anything like that. So, but Charlie walks up to me. We walk up close to the bees, and he says, "Pat, you're going to be the bee tester, and I'm going to be the bee getter. You're going to go up there and test and see if they'll sting, and if they'll sting, I'm going to get them." And so I was the bee tester. And he used to tell me stuff
and
like that.
And did they sting?
And they stung me.
Yeah.
They didn't sting him. But anyway, that was my first experience of a natural storyteller. And I was just so captivated. And we used to drive around every day, like getting rid of the garbage and stuff like that. Every day we go to the dump and to drop the trash off. And he'd say, "Pat, you drive." And so I would drive the car, the truck, and he would put his feet up on the dashboard, and just before he'd fall asleep on the way to the dump, he'd say, "Pat, I'm just as happy as a dead pig in the sunshine." And I didn't know that those were common expressions, you know, living in California, but I was just so captivated by these people. And then eventually I decided to go over to Ireland again, because I had been there for some time doing research for my master's thesis. And I always remember trying to get my ticket. And to get the ticket over there, I had virtually no money. And somebody said, "Well, you should discuss this with Rappaport Travel in New York City." And so I phoned up Rappaport Travel, and they said, "Yeah, we can get you a ticket. We can get you over there for $50. He said, "Well, meet me behind the third column at the KLM terminal. What do you look like?" And and so I met this character, this shady character behind the terminal at KLM, which I guess doesn't even exist anymore. And he hands me this ticket, and he says, "If anybody asks you, a last-minute name change." And it turns out he had booked me on a flight of golfers going to Ireland, and I was the only person on the plane that wasn't wearing plaid pants. But I got to Ireland, and so I just spent, I guess it was about 6 months at that particular time, traveling around and talking to people and listening to storytelling. And storytelling in the traditional sense had died out there because everybody got TVs and radios and it had become a modern place. But the lyricism of people's speech hadn't changed at all. And I just loved the melody and almost never really cared what the story was about. I just really loved to listen to these people talk. So that's how I got interested in storytelling. And then when I eventually came back to California again, had no job or any money, but a friend of mine was a teacher at a third grade school in Mill Valley, California. She says, "Well, since you got nothing else to do, come tell stories to my kids." And so I went in there, and the principal was lurking in the hallway, and he says, "I'll give you $25 if you'd come back and do the whole school." So that was my first professional engagement as a storyteller. And since that time, I've gone on to other things, but that's pretty much how I started. And I think that's the way with everybody. I mean, I just, not to put too fine a point on it, I just flat out fell in love with listening to people tell stories. And that's how I started.
I used to, there's another word for storytellers, of course, and that's natural born liars.
Well, you know, it's funny you should say that, because there's a lot of storytelling festivals around the country, but there are a lot of them which are actually called liars contests, liars competitions. And needless to say, those, you know, are basically, you know, tall tales and fibs and stuff like that. And storytelling is a funny thing because it encompasses every imaginable kind of expression. For a very long time in the storytelling world, most of the people that told stories told fairy tales, things like Grimm and Andersen and Grimm's brothers, and stories that you'd find in books, like about the Irish fairies or the British fairies or something like that. And that was great. Great stories. And then as time went on, people began to tell stories about their own life and their families' lives. And so if you go to a storytelling festival now, probably most of the people will be telling stories about things that either happened to them or a close approximation of what happened to them. And they're really astonishing and beautiful. I know there's one great storyteller that I know of, and I've watched him for many long years. And every time he gets up on the stage, I go, man, I do not want to hear about his little brother anymore. And but every time he starts to tell, I just go, I'm just swept away. And frankly, I tell you, you know, as long as you do a reasonably decent job of it, I defy anybody to not listen, at least for a while, to a good storyteller. And my theory about this is, because people always say, well, you know, how can you possibly compete with, you know, iPods and all these different gadgetry and stuff like that? People's attention spans are so short. How can you possibly deal with that? And my feeling and my experience is that it's in the history of mankind, or womankind, or both kind, the amount of time that they spent sitting around the fire, looking into the fire and listening to people tell stories was probably 99% of the history of the human race. And all this gadgetry and all these distractions are very, very a brief time. And so I think listening to stories and gathering, you know, finding comfort and knowledge and wisdom from stories is embedded in people's DNA. And, you know, a lot of people, some people are less inclined to listen than others, but I think it's always there. And that's one of the gratifications in performing this particular type of art form. And when you mentioned that the Heartland Gallery is relatively intimate, it is pretty intimate. And that's a really marvelous way to hear this kind of stuff, because, you know, part of the joy of telling stories is not just getting the story out, it's to be able to actually look into people's eyes and wonder what's going on in there. Because, as you said so astutely, if I may, these stories are common. Most of the stories are common to very many people. And even if they haven't had the exact experience that you're telling them about, they've had something very similar to it. And so you never really know what's going on in their heads. And the people that come up to you sometimes tell you the most amazing experiences that they had, which were similar to yours. Although, on the other hand, sometimes you misjudge an audience completely. I was doing a show a long time ago in Tiburon, California, for the Tiburon Women's Club. And this is true. They all had white gloves on. They just had a tee, and they all had white gloves on, and they're sitting very sedately in this little concert hall they had there. And I was doing my bit, and they were lit, you know, they were watching me, but they had no reaction whatsoever. But there was a lady sitting in the front row, right in the middle, and she was animated and lively and just obviously thrilled with the whole show. And I thought, well, in that old theatrical maxim, you know, I'll do this show for her, because the other ones don't seem to think much about it. And when it was all over, the ladies in the white gloves came up and they said, thank you so much for coming to our tea. We enjoyed it so much. And I said, well, that lady right there in the front seemed to really like it. And they said, oh, I hope she didn't bother you. She was just released from an asylum. And so, so you never really know, you know, what's going on in people's heads, but it's a great job.
So when you hear a storyteller say, as you said a moment ago, and this is true, is it likely to be? Or is that likely to be the biggest tall tale that they've told all night?
Well, in my case, it's usually true.
Usually.
I mean, I don't. Yeah, in my case, it's usually true. But you know, there are some people who you can't trust. I mean, among storytellers, they'll tell you anything.
Or this is a true story, now, or for real.
Well, the thing is, you know what? It's a real interesting thing because when you do stories for children, the one thing they always want to know afterwards is, was that true? And it's a hard thing to say because, like in a folk tale, which had been passed on for generations of people, nobody that we know was around when it may or may not have happened. And so usually the response is, well, yes, it certainly is true. Whether it's real, I couldn't tell you, but there's always truth in these stories. And that, of course, you know, doesn't satisfy the kids whatsoever.
No,
but.
Of course not. Then they come home and say, Mom, that guy said this,
yeah,
that, and the
other
thing.
Their parents write a letter and say.
Someday hired some liar to talk to our kids.
Yeah.
You're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. We're talking with Patrick Ball today. He's going to be at Heartland Gallery in downtown Urbana for a show tonight at 7:30 till about 9:30, making a return appearance there and here. And we'll be having him bring his harp back here for the last little bit of the show. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home, located at the corner of Elm and University in the historic Trevitt Mansion across from Westside Park in downtown Champaign. Owens Funeral Home, owned and operated by the Owens family since 1925, invites you to join them in supporting public radio. Let's hear some more from the harp.
Sure.
Patrick Ball on Live and Local. What was the name of that tune? It sounded very familiar to me. And I don't know if it's because it was a tune I know or just so many of them sound like tunes you know.
Well, they actually do. I know in my experience, this is going to sound hopelessly metaphysical, but whenever I heard a lot of these tunes, I felt like I heard them before. But the first tune was called Carolyn's Quarrel with a Landlady. And the second tune was Carolyn's Welcome.
So that's the one I have definitely heard before.
Yeah, Ensemble Galilei plays that. They play that song too. A lot of people do. It's a great tune.
I think I have it in a performance probably by the Baltimore Consort.
I haven't heard that one.
Several of their recordings, and at least that's the most likely of my own. But yeah, I've definitely heard it before, whether on harp or other things. Well, Patrick, it has been an absolute treat. I am not surprised, since I've had the chance to, of course, hear your recordings before. And talk to you before, which I always enjoy. And I'm so glad that you like coming back, apparently, to the Heartland Gallery.
I love it. It's a wonderful place, yeah.
Seem to like coming back to the radio show.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks, Kevin. I appreciate it.
Sure. Well, I hope next time you're back at Heartland, you'll be back here as well. And maybe weather and schedules will conspire favorably to allow another live performance.
And maybe I can get one of your parking spaces, too.
Oh, you didn't get one today? Sorry about that. Yeah, we keep losing them to budget cuts. Patrick Ball will be at Heartland Gallery tonight at 7:30. That's in downtown Urbana on Main Street. For more information on the gallery, go to heartland-gallery.com. If you don't put the dash in, you get another Heartland Gallery somewhere else. And for more information on Patrick Ball and how to get one of his many recordings of music and story, go to patrickball.com. You can find out all about him and see lots of pictures and so on. You're listening to Live and Local on 90.9 WYNL FM and HD Urbana with translators W266 AF Urbana and W293 AF Danville, NPR, classical music, and more for Central Illinois. WYNL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois, and we have support from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wine, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available on the Corkscrews Facebook page. It's 101.